Welcome to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy Faye Solomon, delighted to be your host today after a few months' hiatus. The Global Product Management Talk is a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. That is our Twitter handle. Follow us at PRODMGMTTALK. Use the hashtag #PRODMGMTTALK. The Global Product Management Talk is available on iTunes, in the Google Play Store. We even have a Android app. Yes, you're right. It is at PRODMGMTTALK. You can search for our archives online. We're also on Stitcher. We're available on every podcast platform. I'm Cindy Faye Solomon. You can follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon. I tweet about product management, and I'm passionate about product excellence, and I'm just delighted to have the opportunity to speak with experts and thought leaders and people who share my passion for what it takes to achieve excellent products, what the process, methodology, perspectives, and people are necessary to bring this about, to forward what we all care about is building the right products for now that make a difference and for the future. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Kimberly Weifling. She is a founder and president of Weifling Consulting. She's also an author of an excellent series on scrappy project management books. They are hysterical. They are enjoyable to read. And I think she is generously giving away some free copies today to those who are live tweeting. And by the way, you're welcome to call in and join us on the show. If you're listening live, the best quality is to call in and listen live right on your phone. The number to call in is 323-927-2957. That's 323-927-2957. When you do call in, our great engineer, BZ Lewis, our six-time Emmy-winning sound engineer, we'll screen your call and welcome you to chat with us. The Global Product Management Talk is brought to you by our generous sponsors, especially the AIPMM. That's the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. They're at AIPMM. They were founded in 1998, and they promote worldwide excellence in product management education. Through trainings, they are the only international body certifying product managers through the Certified Product Manager, Certified Product Marketing Manager, Agile Certified Product Manager, and Innovation Leader certification, excellent credentials. And they also provide opportunities for corporate members to assure that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. They're at www.aipmm.com. They have an excellent webinar series, and members can get access to those archives. Check them out at aipmm.com. Thank you to audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. You can listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. And you can get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/PROD. MGMTTALK. Check out the Startup Product Movement for Product Excellence. It's startupproduct.com. There's a great blog there. Lots of information about product management principles, methodology, as well as experts, archives. However, I must say that website is undergoing a huge reconstruction right now. So follow on Twitter at Startup Product. There is a career board at jobs.startupproduct.com. And those jobs are posted on the web. So if you are looking to forward your career in product management, product marketing, as well as other product team positions, go to jobs.startupproduct.com and you can subscribe to get a newsletter about upcoming jobs. Check out Webcast Digest for daily curated educational free online events for your continuous learning. Get an hour today, learn something new. Just follow at Webcast Digest. Go to webcastdigest.com to subscribe. We are recording live from studio132.com with BZ Lewis. Thanks to Blame Sally, an excellent local band, for sharing the music with us. You can check out when they're next performing at www.blamesally.com. And I want to do a shout out to the people who attended the Product Summit recently in San Francisco. You can see the excellent lineup of speakers at Product Summit and productsummit.org. We had an incredible 4 days of interactive programming, and Kimberly Weifling was not only spoke on day one during the lightning talks, but she also gave two excellent workshops on day two during workshop day. And Product Summit is coming to Boston in April 2015. That's just 4 months away. So tune in here and follow us on Twitter, and we'll be posting early bird tickets once they are available, which should be hopefully before January 1st. So let's go back. I think I covered everything. Quick shout out to thank our Product Summit sponsors, General Assembly, Pendo.io, GetMingo, great apps from ThoughtWorks, Moxtra, Pentaho, great analytics, Pragmatic Marketing, Product Management Training, Distilled Innovation, Tech Liminal. Check out our sponsors, supporters, and partners. They're listed at Product Summit, and follow the information there if you want to get on board to sponsor the next Product Summit, as well as regular Global Product Management Talks. Okay, Kimberly Weifling is founder and president of Weifling Consulting. She's author of the Scrappy Project Management books, and let me tell you a bit about her. She helps organizations achieve what seems impossible but is merely difficult by turning managers into leaders and groups into teams. She has deep experience with Japanese companies. She's a technologist with human skills, and this is one of the things I love about her. She's a physicist by education. She realized a long time ago the limits of technology when it's devoid of human skills. And so she brings humanness to tech, which I really appreciate. She facilitates highly engaging organizational change and team effectiveness workshops based on her Possibilities Toolbox. Her recent book, Inspired Business Cultures, Discover Your DNA, Engage Your People, and Design Your Future, I think is available. She'll tell us more. She's passionate about making a meaningful difference by working with organizations, individuals, and teams. And you can follow her at Kay Weifling. That's K-W-I-E-F-L-I-N-G. And Weifling Consulting is at weifling.com. Okay, now if you are following us on Twitter, you can use the hashtag #PRODMGMTTALK. You can join us at tweetchat.com. Use the hashtag to find us. And also at crowdchat.net. Use the hashtag as well. Okay, Kimberly, it's your turn.
Hey, Cynthia, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for including me.
Thanks for being here. Is there anything I left out in the intro that you wanted to mention or include?
Well, my first experience with product management happened at Hewlett-Packard. I was working at Hewlett-Packard for 10 years, long ago, and I was a product development program manager for one of their big mass spectrometers, and I really got to learn the hard way about product development, program management, product management. Back then, I really didn't even know the difference between product management and product marketing and product development, program management. So that was really an exciting experience for me, and it has informed everything I've done since with project management.
You know, it's interesting you say that, not knowing the difference between product marketing and product management. I think that that's true still today. That has not changed. People still don't know the difference. And certainly in San Francisco, in startups, they don't have the ability to fund difference. You know, it all falls under get this product out the door and scale it, whatever it takes.
So true. And, you know, the agile methodology, which I think is a great improvement in many ways, they have a terminology of product owner,
yes,
which makes it maybe a little bit more clear. The lingo does get in the way of understanding,
right,
sometimes.
Don't get me started. You know, I feel that the product owner is tactical and involved with the engineering, where product management should be more strategic. And this is a lot of what prompted the meetup communities and the startup product whole movement, you know, distinguishing what are the separations here and what really, even more than the titles, what does it take to really guarantee we're going to develop, design, and launch a product worth building, and that makes a difference not only for the company but for the end users.
Exactly, and having some kind of vision for the future based on a technology roadmap or product roadmap. You know, some people think just because we have agile that we can't plan long term. We can and we must build a long-term vision, and that product manager needs to have that vision based on real-world experience with customers. But beyond that, you know, customers can't always tell you what they want. You have to have a vision beyond what customers are asking for.
Exactly. So today we're talking about failure, which is somewhat of a taboo subject, although, you know, it's talked about more often, especially in the startup and the lean movement arenas. We want to fail fast, but it's still not comfortable, and it's still, I tell people, and certainly been my experience, that I experience failure on a daily basis. It just increases the learning process. It increases that, you know, you're constantly pushing up against failure, but you're getting immediate feedback. But it's not a comfortable place to be, and certainly people do not embrace it, and they don't feel good about it if they think they failed in their company, or the project failed, or the product failed. So you titled today's talk, Design to Fail. Why are individuals, teams, and organizations failing in predictable and avoidable ways? So tell me, explain this title. What, I don't think anyone intends to fail.
Well, let me talk about two kinds of failure. The failure I love are the kinds that are a result of experimentation. If we go into a laboratory and we do experiments, we don't expect every experiment to work perfectly. In fact, we learn more from the experiments that don't work than from the ones that do. And if you're experimenting and you're learning and you're covering new ground, that's very powerful. But on the other hand, there's a kind of failure that is a result of completely predictable and avoidable causes. And it's the kind of thing that at the end of your project, when you sit in your post-project review, or we call them post-mortems, it's very, sounds dire, but the lessons learned that we get out of most project reviews are exactly the same time and again. And in fact, I call this in my scrappy project management book, I call it lessons not learned, because these are the same mistakes, the same failures that we've had on every project, and there's absolutely no reason to let your team fail for those reasons. I say, make sure your team is failing for new and more exciting reasons.
That's excellent. Make sure your team is failing for new and exciting reasons.
More exciting. I mean, we don't need to fail once more because goals were unclear or communication was less than suboptimal, do we?
So what you're saying is that if you're not planning ahead, and if you're not identifying knowledge already known and building that in, then you're guaranteed to fail.
Absolutely. And also the fact that just knowing how to do something has never been a substitute for doing it. I personally am about 10 pounds overweight. I know how to lose weight, Cindy. I know I should eat less. I know I should exercise more. But the difference between knowing and doing is a giant chasm. Now, if we know how to do product development, product management, project management excellence, we know how to do it. It's well documented, but we don't do it. This, in my mind, is a complete failure of leadership, a failure of the team, and a lack of discipline.
So you're saying that knowledge of how to do something does not guarantee execution of doing it right.
Absolutely. You ask anybody, oh, what should we do in order to make sure our project runs properly? Oh, well, of course, we should have trusting relationships. We should communicate effectively. We should define clear goals and align the goals of the team member with the overall goals of the project. We should make sure that we have a clear vision. We should make sure that we're customer-centric and we're navigating off of our customers' needs and market needs. Of course, everyone will say that, but what do they actually do in practice? My observation and plenty of research by people like Harvard and MIT and others demonstrates that it's just not happening.
And so do you think this is a human thing?
Absolutely. Human beings have known tendencies, and I think part of it is we need to be more clear about our biases and our tendencies as human beings, especially when you work in a hierarchical structure. And when I say designed to fail, I'm mostly referring to the fact that organizational structures and hierarchies, as they exist in most companies these days, are causing a lot of this dysfunctionality and predictable and avoidable failure.
Okay, so tell me more about that. And let me do a couple of things. If you are tweeting, I'm going to shout out to you. And I want to give a shout out to the people who have called in to listen live. Welcome. We're glad you're here. And if you do have a question or a comment you'd like to make, you're welcome to tweet it or I think BZ. I'm not sure how you can tell BZ if you're on mute. But if you tweet it, we will see it. So I just want to reference our first question, by the way, if you are tweeting, is always to introduce yourself. Let us know who you are and where you're tweeting from and what your involvement is with product management or product excellence. This is, by the way, meant to be a casual conversation as well as an interaction. So our Q1 question is what do you mean that individual teams and organizations fail predictably and avoidably? So I guess I did ask you that. And Q2 was, now we're going into real world examples of predictable and avoidable challenges. And so you said that organizational structures and hierarchies cause dysfunctionality, but aren't they set up to provide clarity of organization and to increase maybe not so much collaboration, but provide a visual for how to interact within the organization?
Maybe. Maybe that was the intention, but I have bad news. Bob Sutton, professor at Stanford School of Business, he has done a lot of research into managers and leaders, and he published a book last year or so called Good Boss, Bad Boss. And here he describes something called power poisoning. Have you heard of power poisoning?
I have not.
Power poisoning is a characteristic of people who have positional power. So imagine you're the executive in an organization or a director or a manager with power over other people, positional power. Here's what Bob found in his research. People with power, they get more flattering feedback than they give, and that tends to skew their perception of reality. They have less impulse control than others, and so it tends to make them behave badly in stress situations especially, or under frustrating situations, like a project. They think more of their own needs than the needs of other people. Now, I believe in servant leadership, and if you're thinking more of your own needs, that's not going to make you a great servant leader serving the needs of your team. You know, you need to be removing obstacles, providing resources, encouraging and supporting, course correcting. You can't do that if you're thinking of your own needs. He also found that people in positional power have less empathy than people without power. Now, empathizes the first step in the IDEO design thinking cycle, empathizing with customers, but also empathizing with our team members and colleagues and other people who are stakeholders in the project is critical to building a strong team with strong trust. And finally, people with power think the rules don't apply to them. Now, the rules, part of the rules, are the basic common sense best practices that we know work for product development, project management excellence. For example, clear goals, clear priorities, clear communication, all based on a trusting relationship with a team. But bad news, when you look at some research from MIT Sloan Business School on how global teams fail, the number one reason global teams fail is they fail to build trust. The number two reason is they fail to overcome communication barriers, and it has almost nothing to do with language or culture and everything to do with not being able to have healthy conflict and dialogue and discuss differences of opinions in a healthy, open way. And the other two reasons the top four are lack of alignment between the team goals and the individuals on that team, and a complete lack of clear vision and goals in general. Now, that is from research on 70 global business teams. And finally, I'd just like to say, if you think your hierarchy is going to save you, if you think that hierarchy is going to help you clarify your relationships and make the team run more smoothly, you've forgotten a very important fact, that many stakeholders on a project are not in your organization. For example, the customer. The customer does not report into your executive or vice president or CEO. The suppliers, while they may have to do what you want because you're influencing them, they're not reporting into your organization. And I've had suppliers refuse to do business with us because of our behavior. Other stakeholders that are not included, university, research partners, alliance partners, governments, regulatory agencies. There are a tremendous number of stakeholders in any complicated project that do not report into that hierarchy that you've defined. If you don't know how to influence people outside of the hierarchical power structure, you're screwed.
Oh, wow. This is a lot of rich things here. So much here. So I cannot tweet fast enough to capture it. So are you making a case? A lot of these things is obvious, certainly if we look at politics, people in power, it's really obvious there how
so true.
They're not looking at, what serves their constituents, and they're on a power trip. What one of the things I love about smaller organizations and startups is they may attempt to be a flat organization, which means that ideally everyone is equal, everyone has an equal say. But I will say in driving, the product summit is hugely driven through a volunteer effort. It's really difficult to not have a strong leadership and points of authority. Everyone cannot be equal, even if they are equally experienced or expert or knowledgeable. There still needs to be some direction, and there still needs to be someone willing to take the fall when things aren't working.
I agree that there's a need for leadership. And I think there's a big difference between leadership and management. And what I'm talking about in this hierarchy is the management. I look at managers all over the world. I've worked with people in 50 different countries. I find lots of managers, but not many leaders. And when I do find leaders, I find them at all levels of the organization, including in the individual contributor role. I personally, when I was at Hewlett-Packard and then several different startups where I was the product development program manager, I was mostly an individual contributor with no positional power and no hierarchical authority over the people on my team. My teammates came from different divisions or different functional groups. I had only influence. And I think managing and leading a volunteer organization is perfect practice for leading an effective product development team.
Excellent. Great to hear. I mean, that's really why it's set up, to give people an opportunity to get involved in all of the initiatives, from startup product to the meetups to the product summit, because it's very hard to get into product management, especially if you have no experience. Even if you're coming from a technical background, you still need those communication skills, those leadership skills. But you're giving me some great distinctions between management and leadership. And a lot of what I talk about when I think about product managers is really product leaders. leaders.
Yes.
But when people hear product leader, they think that's the visionary, that's the founder, that's the developer. And so you're really helping me to articulate what do I mean by a product leader. And I want to underline that leadership can be found at any level. It's not a title thing. It's based on the behavior and the actions and the results produced.
Absolutely. I like to say manage cows, lead people. I mean, you can manage schedule, you can manage budgets, manage requirements, but don't try to manage people. People don't want to be managed. If you look at the data from Barry Posner and Jim Kouzes from the Leadership Challenge, the best leadership research in the world, they've done research on the characteristics of people willingly followed, leaders who are willingly followed, not because of force, coercion, or hierarchy. And the top four characteristics all over the world are, number one, these people must be honest. So openness, transparency, and how you're making decisions, and just not lying to people. Number two is they must be forward-looking. They have to be looking to the future. People want to follow a leader who's going somewhere and communicates where they're going. The first question people have of their leaders is, who are you? And the second question they have of leaders is, where are we going, if I should follow you? And the third characteristic of people willingly followed is they're inspiring. Now, you don't have to be hugely charismatic, but you can fake it. You know, talk about your product with passion. Talk about the customer's needs and the purpose beyond profit. Talk about how the world will be different, better, changing because of what you're doing in your product. And finally, people expect their leaders to be competent. So honest, forward-looking, inspiring, competent. And notice, none of those words are linked to hierarchy or title. It's not a position on a business card or a title in a hierarchy to be honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent. Those are behaviors, and any one of us can exhibit those behaviors on our product development project team.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to make sure, let's see. So going back to, you're kind of talking about what's missing in projects and in programs and products that have failed. But then we see a lot of smart, educated, and experienced professionals who have had lots of success, but then they will also fail for preventable reasons. But how do you catch that? If something is you know, a train wreck, how do you fix it midstream, or do you have to wait till you get the results to do the debrief and to you know, identify what went wrong?
Absolutely not. I like to do the post-project review on day one. I like to ask the team to imagine we are at the end of the project and we are looking at what went wrong, and the post-project lesson learned are thought about right there up front so that we can avoid them. That's called risk analysis and risk management. You know, the problem with a lot of risk management strategies is people take time to brainstorm the risks and then they do absolutely nothing to mitigate those risks. Don Reinerstein wrote an excellent book called Developing Products in Half the Time. And I saw him speak one time, and he said the number one mistake that teams make in risk management is to analyze the risk and do absolutely nothing to mitigate it. Isn't that a pity?
Yes. So you're talking about they actually do the due diligence. They go through the process, but then it doesn't make change.
Because, you know, they barely have enough time and money to do the basics that are required for the Rev 1.0 out the door. And so who has time to think about, gosh, should we mitigate this risk by doing something in parallel or spending a little bit of money? You know, no need to waste your time analyzing risk if you're not going to do something to mitigate that risk. And I also think there's another thing that's at work here is, you know, sometimes people are successful because they were lucky. And they mistakenly assume it was because they were good.
Right.
And then their luck runs out.
Right.
You know, that is why I don't rely on luck. I think luck is not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy. I rely on using what's known to work with discipline and using a checklist. You know, surgeons who use a checklist have fewer complications in their patients after surgery. And no pilot, no airplane pilot would ever think of taking off without going through their checklist. Can you imagine? You get on the flight, you're sitting in your economy class seat, and you hear the pilot say, "Sorry, people, we're kind of running short of time today, so we've skipped the pre-flight checklist." Really? I would not be staying on that plane. And do you want to be on a product development team that hasn't gone through the basics? But many times people use this as an excuse. Oh, we're too busy. You know, they're adrenaline junkies. They created the train wreck. You don't even need to create the train wreck, but it's so much more exciting to be a hero and have diving catches and firefighting instead of fire prevention. Fire prevention is boring.
You talked about, there's not enough resources. And this is what I find with product managers also. You know, once one product is shipped, we're on to the next product. Who has time to step back to get some perspective on what worked or what didn't? And this is why I love project managers, because they're tasked. It's their job to do that
postmortem too. Maybe that's it. It's like birthing a baby.
It is. Right? That's what I say. The product manager is birthing this product to life.
So true.
There is a, certainly I experience a post.
Even when you do a lessons learned, what happens is we get the lessons learned. And what do we do with them? How do we communicate those to the next team? Or how do we integrate that into the product development life cycle so that it will inform future projects? You know, I love a product development life cycle that allows flexibility to adapt it, but you should incorporate the recipe to success there. And teams should depart from that process thoughtfully, not follow it lockstep.
Okay, so talk more about this, and really, if you could give a real world example of how to do this, because I don't want this to be yet another here's knowledge that I have, and the research that you're citing is excellent. And note to self, or to someone who would like to take on listening to the transcript and pulling out this research, so we can add it to the resources. So how do you? We're talking about gaining the knowledge from what worked to what didn't work. But then how do you actually execute with that knowledge?
I think you have to have in your mind your own simple checklist that's based on known practices proven to work. For me, I have a very simple 4-step checklist in my head. I start with big why. Why are we doing this project? What's the purpose? And I'm not talking about just to make money. What's the purpose beyond profit? Of course, profit is important. Because if we're not profitable, we're not sustainable, we can't do it again next year. But the big why is the starting point. And then we go on to the big who. Who cares? Who can help us? Who can hurt us? Who will benefit from this project? Who is going to be impacted? Who will be impacted if we don't do it or do it improperly? And one of those stakeholders so key is the customer and all of the customers all along the value chain. Because sometimes in B2B, we're talking about someone who makes a decision versus someone who actually distributes the product or service versus somebody who is the end user of that product or service. So the stakeholder analysis is absolutely crucial. And knowing the customer's needs requires getting out of the building. Love Steve Blank and his lean business model approach. He said there are no answers in this building. There's no customers in this building. Get out of the building and talk to 100 real customers. I worked with people at Hewlett-Packard who had never even used the instruments they designed. I worked with people at Hewlett-Packard who had never seen a real customer or a real customer lab. They didn't even go downstairs to manufacturing until I forced them to go down there and see what was really happening. You can build something lovingly in your R&D lab. It's way different when you try to produce it in volume in manufacturing, or when the poor customer is sitting there in front of it in tears because they don't know how to use the damn thing. So I think it's really important to do a stakeholder analysis and deeply explore the customer's reality, create personas to keep that customer reality in front of the team at all times. That's another great attribute of the IDEO innovation process. The empathizing is then turned into personas that can keep the team aware of the stakeholders. So we have the big why, the big who, then we go on to the big what. Now, what exactly is success? Now, a lot of people, they say, well, here's what I think is success. Nobody cares what you think is success. What do the key stakeholders think? What does the customer see as a successful product? What's good enough quality for the customer? What's the price quality ratio that your customer wants? You know, a lot of people are designing products for people who look just like them. Unfortunately, their customers don't look just like them or think like them. And I think it's really important to set up success criteria through the eyes of the stakeholders that you intend to delight. So the big why, the big who, the big what, measurable success criteria, then we get on to the big how. And this is where we talk about what is our plan, our schedule, our strategy, the milestones, due dates, phases, deliverables. And all of these things that I've talked about, it's not a waterfall. You cycle through those again and again. You go through big why, big who, big what, big how, and then you say, well, we have to rethink the big why. Now that we've gone through this exercise, maybe our purpose can be sharpened. And maybe now we've forgotten a few stakeholders that we can add in. So now that we've gone through this process, it informs a more rich discussion of the big why, big who, and big what. And round you go in a spiral, like we do in Agile. It's not ever been a waterfall, actually, even in the old days.
I agree. There's no purity, nor should there be. You know, if you want to talk about process, look, a great process does not make a great product.
Right.
If only it did. If only it were that easy. And really, you know, in my trying to define, well, what is product excellence? How do you achieve it? Well, you know, people first, which you're talking about, and that includes all the stakeholders and even the invisible ones. And then the knowledge necessary, which you're now identifying. How do you achieve the knowledge? What are these four questions to ask? And then process based on what those first two criteria, who are the people involved and who are the stakeholders, what process serves and supports what their needs are.
Absolutely. Just enough process to optimize the results. Not a drop more, not a drop less. That's the discipline required and not bureaucracy.
Right. Which is really high level, really requires mastery and more mastery than, you know, and I think that the Scrum Masters and people who really do study process but have been through a lot of implementations, they understand. And they use process to discuss it through language. But what they demonstrate is what really works is the attention to the people involved. It's the intention of the process,
right,
not the process itself.
Yes, the process is a framework, and we depart from it thoughtfully, not carelessly. So you start with something that's a framework, and then you can say, look, can we take the risk of going forward from this particular step in the product development lifecycle? Maybe we don't have all the answers yet. All right, we know we're proceeding at risk, and we make a conscious choice to do that, but you don't just blunder on blindly. And I think a lot of people are under this illusion that just because they're busy, they're productive, and they're coming in and they're doing diving catches and firefighting, and they're big heroes, and they feel so intensely excited because of the adrenaline rush. But if you follow what's known to work with clarity and discipline, occasionally there will be fires, but at least you won't have caused them yourself, which I think most of the firefighters I've met carry matches. They are starting the fires.
Yeah, and you know, that's an unfortunate thing also, that people realize the need for product management intentionally when there is a fire, as opposed to before, because they're technology driven, or they're engineers, so they're focused on solving a problem. They're not focused on what is the process to solve the problem, or who do we need to help us solve the problem. They're like, I can develop something new that is a solution, and that's what the, you know, where their focus is.
Well,
I'm using my hand to point to the focus.
I'm pointing with you, Cindy. But I'm strongly I strongly believe that human beings would much rather take a painkiller than a vitamin. And if you try to be upfront telling people, you know, here's what we need to do in order to align ourselves with what's known to work, they'd be like, oh, don't worry your pretty little head about it. What could possibly go wrong? And I'm quoting from my own experience. People have asked me, Kimberly, what could possibly go wrong? And then I roll out my list of, here's 147 things that I've brainstormed just personally that could go wrong. And I'm thinking about how to thoughtfully incorporate those into our plan, not to the point where we don't move forward, but to the point where we avoid the predictable pitfalls. Now, sometimes we're going to have to fall into a hole and dig our way out of it. That's okay. That's part of the process. I love that. You know, you experiment, you fail forward, and then you recover. That's very important. But I don't want to fall into the same pothole as the last 10 projects. And that's what most teams are doing.
Right. Do it once, maybe fail forward once, but don't keep repeating it because that's awfully taxing on the team.
Yeah, and people use as an excuse, oh, we're really busy. We're too busy to include the voice of the customer, too busy to do a stakeholder analysis, too busy to look at a carefully thought out success scorecard. Really too busy. You can do all of those things in the matter of 2 or 3 hours with the team in the room, flip charts, post notes. There's absolutely no excuse. Every day that you spend in planning saves about 10 days of wasted time and effort, according to Stephen McConnell's Software Project Survival Guide. And the best software developers, for example, spend a lot more time thinking about the requirements and planning and designing before they write a single line of code.
Yeah. Yes. What was that book you just mentioned?
Stephen McConnell, Software Project Survival Guide. Great book. Been out for a long time, but every bit as relevant today as it ever was, in my opinion.
It's a lot of books I have to add to my library here.
I'm a geek.
It's awesome. It's awesome. You don't look like a geek.
Thank you.
I must say.
One time someone came up to me and said, you don't look like a physicist. Well, I took that as a compliment.
Right. Which, you know, certainly it's a great thing. It's one of the things that I really appreciate about you. Being a geek and looking like a geek myself.
I think we're defining what the new geeks look like. The 21st right. century geek, this is us.
Right. Female.
Yeah. Wild and free.
By the way, you're listening to the Global Product Management Talk. I forgot to do the half hour session check-in. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. There are over 150 episodes in archives there. You can get a lesson with resources and expertise in each one. You can find us on the web and on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK. Thanks to our live listeners and our tweeters. Our tweet stream will probably pick up afterwards, although currently the reach is 126,000. So if you'd like to sponsor Global Product Management Talk, you will get a wide reach, both live and on demand after the fact when it's out on iTunes. So let's see. Having a lot of fun here. Let me go back to the questions to just check in. Excuse me while I shuffle. Where are my questions? Here they are. Okay, they were on top. All right, so let's see. Okay, so Q6, must you be an executive to make widespread changes in your organization's culture? And that's, you know, we're talking about great things and you're saying you don't have to have, you know, a title to be a leader, but certainly isn't it the executive? And it's more obvious in smaller organizations. It is the executive sets the tone, the personality, or if you will, the culture of how people operate, even if they bring in, because they're going to choose who they want to work with. And certainly they're defining the direction and how things operate. People are by nature going to be in reaction to the executive leadership.
I think you're right that the executive especially the top executives, do set the tone for the organizational culture. In my new book that I'm working on with Dr. Edgar Schein, the father of organizational culture, my new book does address the fact that organizational culture influences everything that happens, and that's why I've become so fascinated by it. I would say, though, if you think about an organization, think about a flock of birds, all right? Maybe hundreds of birds in a field, and then they all take off together, and they swoop around, and they fly as a flock. There is no CEO bird. There is no bird project plan. They don't have a bird strategy meeting to decide who's going to fly where. You know, they have a context in which they are flying. They have some operational rules that influence how they operate and some capabilities as birds. And that's kind of like the corporate culture and how it influences human beings. But once they take off, they are not being directed by a great autonomous being in the sky. And I think we need to do something like that as executives. Executives need to create an environment where people can be self-directed and can do their best. Now, being an executive may be helpful if you want to shift the culture of your company, but it's not very helpful at getting operational changes implemented because the executives are cut off from honest feedback. Quite frankly, people are afraid to speak the truth to them. One CEO said, "The last time anyone told me the truth was the day I was promoted to CEO." And so it's much better if you want to make change happen at the product development, project management level. It's better for you to be working at that level because you can decide to have a project charter. You can decide to recruit an executive sponsor. You can decide to have a sensible communication strategy and to follow basic project management best practices with discipline. Nobody can force people to do that. An executive cannot force people to do that. They can only create an environment where they invite people to do that. And in this valley with the job market like it is, if people don't like working with you, they can just quit.
Yeah, if they're an engineer.
If they're an engineer. Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I think anybody, you know, start where you are, do what you can with what you have. Think big, start small, move fast, like you said at the beginning. Anybody can make change happen just by changing their behavior. Even if you're just a member of a project team and you're at a meeting with the product manager, you can raise your hand and you can say, "Can you help me understand more about our customer's needs? Can you clarify the requirements?" Through the power of asking respectful questions, anybody can lead from any chair in that team.
Asking respectful questions as opposed to any question.
Yeah, like saying, "What were you thinking?" That's not the kind of question.
That's a very good distinction, respectful questions, because I encourage people to ask questions, but how they ask and what they ask is just as important as asking at all.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of the core team structure that Michael McGrath put forth in his PRTM's book, Setting the Pace in Product Development. Really old book, but still very true to this day. The core team approach has a team shown in a circle. Of course, there's a leader of the team, but just like in a car, there's many parts of a car. Well, which part of the car is the leader? Is it the engine, the steering wheel, the gas pedal, the brake? You know, they work together as a system, and people on the team have different roles and responsibilities. One of those roles and responsibilities is to be the leader, and that is serving the team, not directing, being an autocrat for the team.
It reminds me a lot of what mob programming is and all the principles behind it. And Woody Zuhl came up from South California earlier this year to talk about mob programming and to show how his team does it. And it's all, they actually literally sit in a circle and they deliver every hour. And they each take turns either programming. They're all working on one machine. And so they're programming all together. They're doing programming, QA, communications, everything in one room and delivering. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I love face-to-face. If you can have your whole team in one room looking at each other and being able to feel free that they have enough trust that they can go and talk with each other, or that I can come and give you some feedback on something that's not part of my job and vice versa. Those kinds of things are worth way more than some bossy executive.
Right. And I just noticed how much more productive I am I try and do my programming with developing content, developing messaging, the product marketing aspects of launching the product. And it seems like, wow, if it, you know, wouldn't it be more productive if five individuals were, you know, cranking out content and then we got together and edit? And it actually was much more, we got to an end product in each session when we worked together. It was painful. I won't say that it was easy to do. It was extremely painful, but quite valuable.
Well, if it was easy, it wouldn't be a competitive business, right? It's the reason we can do this as a business and make a profit at it is because it's difficult, it's challenging, and we can overcome those challenges. There are lots of tools to help teams do that. I think the worst possible approach to achieving results in a team is to sit around the table and discuss it. You know, you get up there at the flip chart with some post notes, or you get online and crowdsource or mob program, like you said, and you separate idea generation from critique and idea selection. And I think a lot of times teams are combining idea generation with idea critique and selection. And when you do that, you kill everyone's enthusiasm and you will kill every single idea before it's even born.
But it's also difficult to work with a team. I'm just thinking of, you know, how I, you know, we put the product summit on with volunteers. Some of the feedback we're getting is, hey, the volunteers wanted to come in earlier. You know, they came in too late. The train had already left the station, so they missed the context. They missed what was the intention of why it was set up that way.
And they want to contribute to shaping it. You know, if people get to shape what they participate in, they buy into it much more. It might be perfect, but if you didn't ask them their input, they're going to say, well, how about you change this or that? You know, they reject it just because they didn't have a hand in creating it.
Right. But you know, to the point of being a leader, you have to let go of your ego.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's not easy. That's why we have power poisoning. And believe me, the people who are doing this power poisoning behavior do not think it's them. If you ask people who is creating this sick, twisted, dysfunctional culture in our team, everyone will say, it's not me, it's the others.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, except, you know, when you are the leader.
Well, when you're the leader, the de facto leader, you have to look in the mirror and say, whether I feel like it or not, I am contributing to this debacle or this failure or difficulty. And I think part of the reason, Cindy, and I think it's a problem of how we talk about the human side of our business. I hear people talking about the touchy-feely crap. And when we call it the touchy-feely crap or the soft skills, we lower the value of that. And we don't put it into the schedule. We don't put time in the schedule for team building, for relationship building, for communication, for blowing off steam together. You know, if that was really important to us, working as a team, not just a group of people, we would put it into the damn schedule.
You know, I think it's the languaging. And I really appreciate your pointing this out. It's not technical languaging. And you know, that you even call it out is we should not be belittling or diminishing quote unquote soft skills.
Right.
And that's really where, you know, marketing and those other things. So those are not the hard, you know, development issues, but they really need to be included from the beginning.
Absolutely. And they need to be on the scorecard of success. You can measure the soft skills at the end of the project. Does the team ever want to work together ever again? Oh, how many people have quit? Turnover is a great measure of how well you've done working as a real team. But if we don't measure it, it doesn't matter. Whatever's rewarded gets repeated. We need to put those team skills on the scorecard. We need to say our team functioned as a real team on a scale of 1 to 7. How much do we agree with that? And it better hit at least 6.5. Otherwise, we have failed in this metric. And our communication, are we having plenty of communication? If we survey all of our stakeholders and we get less than this measure on our survey, then we failed. But it's almost never on the scorecard.
Excellent. You know, we're coming to the end of the hour, so I want to give you the opportunity to underline Not only the points you've made, everything you've said is excellent, and I can't wait to get my hands on the transcript of this. So much rich value. But please tell us where you're speaking next, where people can get your books, underline how to get in touch with you, and I will do a post review of the participants to award your books to.
Well, my book that's most famous around the world is Scrappy Project Management, The 12 Predictable and Avoidable Pitfalls Every Project Faces. It is available on Amazon, along with the other 5 Scrappy Guides, which I'm the editor of, Scrappy Information Security, Scrappy Business Contingency Planning, both written by Michael Cease. And then we have Scrappy General Management, written by Michael Horton. And finally, we have a book that I wrote with 11 other scrappy business women called Scrappy Women in Business. And I think all of those books are very irreverent and fun to read, as well as being very valuable. The Scrappy Project Management book is also available in Japanese. It was translated by Nikkei Business Press, the most popular business translation and publishing service in all of Japan. I do go to Japan pretty much every month for the last 8 years on business, so a lot of my work is outside of the Silicon Valley, but I'm hoping to change all that, so if you're listening, give me a call. I would love to go to work without getting on an airplane. I also will be in Chicago beginning of January, then back to Tokyo January, February. I'm always available in the Silicon Valley by email or phone call, or look at my website, www.weefling.com, hard to spell, W-I-E-F as in fun, L-I-N-G.com. There's plenty of information there, and I always welcome a conversation for possibilities. You know, if you don't need me, then definitely I wouldn't bother to introduce me to your organization. But if you do need a dose of Kimberly, there's no substitute. And I will work with you to help your managers become real leaders. And I will work with you to help groups of people work together as real teams. And doing that, that is what makes it possible to do what other people say is impossible.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Kimberly. I've just been delighted to have you join us. And you live here in Silicon Valley, though.
I live in Redwood City, just 15 minutes from the San Francisco airport, handy for my travel schedule. And I would love to do talks or workshops or coaching or consulting for any organization committed to transforming their product development, project management teams to be truly excellent.
Thank you so much. You heard it here on the Global Product Management Talk. Thank you for listening. This will most likely be our last episode of 2014. Follow us at PRODMGMTTALK. We will be coming up with the lineup of talks for 2015, as well as a Product Summit Boston in the spring, and more meetups, events, and digital events. You can find out about the meetups by going to sfproducttalks.com, as well as startupproduct.com/meetup. If you'd like to start a startup product meetup to discuss product excellence, product management, project management, process tools, and all the elements necessary, you can bring a startup product meetup to your community. Thank you again to BZ Lewis, Studio 132. Thank you to our sponsors at AIPMM, AIPMM.com, WebcastDigest.com, Audible.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Again, check out jobs. startupproduct.com and follow the productsummit.org as the updates for the upcoming summits will be put there, and additional information about the speakers and the content from the last event. This is Cindy Faye Solomon. I'm at Cindy F. Solomon, and you can email me, cindy@startupproduct.com, with suggestions for speakers if you'd like to sponsor and get involved. Thanks again, Kimberly, for joining us.
Thank you, Cindy, for having me. I had a great time.
Excellent. Have a great holiday season and a new year, and have a great week.
On a dry winter leaf, I wouldn't know love if you found me.